A lot of trouble with that left shoulder.
Oh, he'll only be on for about half hour. I'd like to capture some of the spelling for people. So, my name is Barbara. I'm vice chair, and we're going to start this section. And,
I am a quality medicine analyst with Kodak Health Recovery and Wellness, and I brought a few things.
Kathleen Tanner, also a quality management analyst, but I work part time. Kodak.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Tina Sarginski. I am from Arizona Health, and I'm the mental health first aid coordinator as well as a certified instructor for mental health first aid curriculum.
Welcome.
Hi, this is Melissa Brown. I'm with Arizona Complete Health and the Zone Family Care Center.
Phyllis Grant, family member and Southern Regional Director for Family Involvement Center.
Thank you, Phyllis, for being here.
In your mom's foster care and adoptive mom.
And, okay, everyone on the phone, please. If you introduce yourself.
This is Joe Mashensky, family member.
Thanks, Joe.
Ken Carroll.
Okay. Thanks, Ken.
Larry Howell with ADOA.
And hi, everyone. It's Sophie with United Healthcare.
Hi, Sophie.
It's Joe Coutsman with Banner.
This is Jakeisha Hughes with CareFirst Health Plan.
Tyson Gillespie from Community Partners.
Hi, Tyson. Hi, Jakeisha.
This is Frederica Graham with Access.
Good morning, Frederica. Okay, good. Okay, so anyway, regarding, let's review our minutes again. Those are posted online. And Larry, do you have anything to start up with from ADOA? I mean, do you have any news or any announcements? I did receive your email today, and I did distribute those the requests for comment and information. I did distribute that to the committee members. Do you want to touch on that?
Well, I just wanted to send that out to the group. I really can't expand on it. Frederica might know a little bit more about that, but I just wanted to get that out to the to the committees. To review, and if you can make it to the forum, to please do so if you can. If you can't, that's fine too. I think you're able to call in on those forums as well. So, but I wanted just to get that out to the group. Other than that, I really don't have any updates from ADOA's perspective yet today. So, but happy to be here and good morning.
Thanks, Larry. And I did receive the flyers, and I've got them on the table here, and we'll get those distributed. Thank you very much for the.
You're welcome. The business cards have been ordered, so those unfortunately take a while to get in for some reason. So as soon as we get those in, I'll turn those around and get those over to you, Barb.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, we'll move on to focus group. And Jason, with any luck, our Officer Winsky will check in with us. And member recruitment. We need member recruitment.
Yep. Yeah, let me just jump in. Barb, excuse me. I think Phyllis has been here two or three times already, attendance, and certainly she should be considered when it's appropriate to or voting as a member and in terms of membership. So I just thought I'd interject that.
Okay. hopefully, is it possible to vote on our third, on her third attendance? Because next time will be her third.
Right, right. Just a FYI.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thanks, Ken. And then outreach. Thank you again, Larry, for material for our outreach.
Are you welcome?
And then a death incident. The last I spoke with Joanna, which I'm excited, she was attempting to get on the server to do some work on that, was going to report on that. So we'll have to wait to hear from Joanna. And anyone else within the committee, Joe, anybody that would be willing to work on the death and incidents online, it would be wonderful. They've really set it up well for us to access it now. It's so much better. Anyone else that has time to look into that? And the same with seclusion restraints. That's on an FTP server, but they've done a brilliant job of making it easier to access. All it takes is time with all of the items. And then board and care, Ken and I did not get to that this last month. This last month has been challenging for a lot of us, February. But we'll work toward getting some more board and care visits. Any comments on board and care, anyone? Ken, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I do. One of the things I want to just get to Melissa is we need to have some type of review as to what folks are being charged. The range is anywhere from $500 to $950, and sometimes the rooms are the same. But the determination is built on, determined by, as far as the cost or the expenditures by the client, person, resident, by how much money they have. So that needs to be looked at, Melissa, in terms of the, I realize, you know, this gets, you know, it's quite a broad area, but to have a range of 500 to 950 and maybe people are in the same setting, but some people have more money than maybe they reported a TV in their room or something like that, but 950 and who knows how many others. So that was one of the things I think we discovered on our last home visit, both Barb and I, and it was really kind of an eye-opener. So my question and raising the question here is just a small sample. I realize that. However, how many other places are there that are charging $900 and then a comparable, maybe the next room over is paying $500? So something we're going to have to pursue on that. I just want to get that at both the terms of both Larry, be aware of that, because I'm sure it's going on in other places, other as far as north and central, and we need to follow up on that. So end of discussion on that, but it'll lead to more when we go out to look at a little closer as to the rate of determination when someone's charged that much money.
This is Frederica. Are you referring to residential placements?
Boarding homes, unlicensed boarding homes.
Yeah, well, a room and board situation there that Barb and I went to last month.
Okay. If you guys want to do an inquiry to the IOC inbox, we can look into that for you. This is Frederica with Access.
Okay. Yeah, I think there should be some clear. I realize you can't have underlying price line, but at least there has to be some closer review. And that would also be, I would think, the caseworker or support staff going out from the respective REBA could certainly be looking at that as an issue that, you know, what are they being charged? What are they paying? What's being offered? So I'd like to officially enter that as an issue to be looked at.
Hey, Ken, this is Melissa, and I totally agree with you that that's a ridiculous amount for people to pay. Unfortunately, since it's an unlicensed boarding home, we have, like, no authority over it whatsoever, so it's completely up to that member if they want to pay that much. I'm not saying that that's right, but unfortunately, with the unlicensed boarding home, we can't put a range of what they have to charge, unfortunately.
Well, take exception to that. I understand what you're saying, but I think we can look at that and question the home, and that should be certainly questioned. And again, to leave it to the resident, it's a rather naive assumption that he or she, given the quandary, it's Friday at 3 o'clock and they found a place for him, but it happens to be $900. That just is a secondary issue. So my point is simply to look into it. I'm not saying we can make a universal blank statement, because no, that would not be. But at least it has to be reviewed at and seeing what they are paying. But to simply say that the client didn't complain, well, I think it's a no-brainer.
And hopefully our providers are talking to them about paying such a high amount, especially if they don't have money to pay for their other things that they need to buy.
Sure, incidentals.
Yeah, I can speak from Kodak. I know our recovery coaches go out each month to meet with those members that we've identified that live in a boarding home. And one of the discussions is bringing up, you know, if they're able to afford the cost of living, and also offering them, you know, other options that they can move into. And I know I can't speak specifics, but I know in the past, if there's any indication that a member's being abused, there's some sort of, you know, like taken advantage of, the recovery coaches staff that with their supervisor, and usually there's like an APS report filed, and Adult Protective Services gets involved. But I know that's something that, you know, providers are doing. At least I can speak from Kodak, going out having that discussion with them.
Yeah, and they should, for all the providers. So if anybody hears that they're not doing something like that, if you could please let us know if it's an Arizona Complete Care member.
Does anyone in the audience anywhere know of who? Thank you, Frederica. We can't put in a request, but do you know of who we could go to? Because in visiting this site, the manager there, and they have this unlicensed group that we visited, Ken and I, have five different sites, and she said to me, well, what we do is we assess how much they have to spend, and that's how we kind of base what we charge. And I'm thinking, whoa, you know, and so it's based on, and she says, we of course want them to have some money to buy some items. And so there wasn't a flat understood rate. So I agree with you, Ken. This really, if possible, we should look somehow into that or put some pressure somewhere for them to not be doing any predatory type.
It comes under exploitation. And again, I think it can be monitored by simply looking when the placement's made, what is the expected, price that they will pay, and it shouldn't be based on the person's individual assets or, basically, just like if you or I went to rent an apartment and everybody in is paying the same rate, except, well, you have a little more money, so the landlord's going to charge you more. So it's a no-brainer, but we can move on. I just don't want to make a big deal about it, but I will not, we won't just abandon the issue.
Good point. I'd like to welcome, we have a quorum. Joanna is here with us. Thank you. Yes, this is you. And I'm going to back up to Steph.
I haven't gotten through as many reports as I would have liked. I didn't find anything of Methadone dosing. didn't end up at that site for coaching, and they're looking at potential continuity of care issues. He didn't. I think he's just at large. And they have and I think his service plan was out of date, and that was me. But other than that,
and I will admit from my side, I look at the with restraint and seclusion reports, and it is challenging to see actually what's going on. I mean, there is a report, yes, but it is, without reading it, just trying to get down into the narrative, if you can find it, it is challenging to find. We're an oversight committee, right? It's really challenging to oversee these particular types of reports. Put it again on these computers for us to have access at home, but again, getting into the reports is challenging. So all the eyes, anybody willing to help us on this would be appreciated. So anyone else willing to get on board and help us with accessing these reports and reading them would be much appreciated. Okay, add over. Thank you.
Thank you. We have talked in the last meeting about what if one of the reports did turn up something, and there's a built-in form right in the portal for every incident that whoever's doing the report can submit for further investigation.
Excellent. Frederica, does the incident when we make comments on that portal, do those come to you, those reports, if we have comments?
Yes, you would, if you have any comments, whereas you're wanting more feedback or wanting to file some type of, information request, you would just need to send that through the IOC at azdoa.gov email address, and those come directly to me. But that's our tracking mechanism for it.
So that form that's filled out doesn't automatically come to you then?
Yes.
But that's
it should. If we're referring to the same thing, then I don't know exactly how you all see it on your end, because my end is a little bit different. But I know that the central IOC, when they make a request, it usually comes by way of, a formal request that they've submitted online. And then that request or that form comes directly to our IOC email address. And then that comes to me.
I think she's talking about the QIC inquiry on the IAD portal. So
yeah.
I'm sorry you guys didn't know that. I thought you guys knew that. Yeah, so each time if you have, a question about the quality or there's an issue, you can submit that QOC inquiry form that she's talking about to get further information.
We're still learning. It's such a new
I know. Concept. There's so much stuff.
And it's so new.
Yeah.
What would you like to know? I know from what you would say, that I'd like to know that you're trying to make it to the council and the kids results. If they... member didn't go in, or where it was, did they stop at the gas station and the member took off, or did they get to the facility and the member just didn't go in? That would be, instead, I took a photo of the form, the third question, sent to the contractor / the mailbox and the access IOC form. And then you can also add
Count me in, please.
I think you can ask what you want to. I don't know if they want to clarify that, but I believe you can ask whatever you want.
Member, do you text boxes for an investigation requested? Report is illegible, report is incomplete, or inadequate to identify possible rights violations,
regarding client deaths for others, and then we'll just blank form children.
That is marvelous. See, it's new to us, the system, and I must say, Larry, or whoever, Frederica, thank you. The system, I'm warming up to it. It's been a long time coming, and it sounds like it's used, but quite usable. You just have to get in there and use it. Well, thank you so much.
Definitely helpful to actually go in, look at things. Because all of this might have been, probably was in the training, but it's.
Well, there's so much to remember.
It's so much to get
it. Yeah, and you're not doing it every day, so it's just given that.
And special populations. Susan is wondering, Phyllis, do you have anything to say?
I don't really have anything other than what I discussed last time. I'm working on some issues with the school districts regarding enrolling kids who have special needs but don't yet have an active IEP and how my son can even help with that. But other than that, I can't really think of anything that jumps out at me.
Yeah, good. Frankly, yeah.
And for foster care, in May, we're going to have the Blue Ribbon event, which is an event, and I don't have the exact date yet, but I'll let everybody know. It's a free event for foster parents that are licensed and unlicensed to come to a location, and then we have food and games and everything like that. It's something that we put on every year. So it's a lot of fun. We have resources there. I think last year you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have a ton of resources that set up for foster parents. They will go and talk to each one of the resources to get more information about what's up.
Excuse me. This is Joe with Banner. Who's speaking right now? I can hardly hear. So
Sharon with Intermount Foster Care.
Sharon.
Oh, okay.
So we put it on every May. It's a great event, and then whoever wants to participate, we can always see about putting up a table. Last year we did have like six there, and we have more than a bed. Gladys came last year from ABCA, stuff like that. So we kind of do a mini resource fair at the same time.
I think those
didn't the meeting right now. Oh, so I'll let you know.
Okay, I'll distribute too.
Okay.
And then I'll get it to Larry too, and he can post it. And, you know,
I don't know how public they put it out there because parents aren't allowed to be there.
Oh, yes.
The safety of the children that are currently in care.
Okay.
Which is why I won't list the location. But it is a great event for licensed and unlicensed foster parents and for kids and problems like that. We have had issues in the past with more parents showing up and causing whatever.
Yeah.
So we have to hire security every year like that to make sure somebody is safe.
And I will say, as far as foster parents are concerned, their family involvement center, we've seen an uptick in foster parents requesting support and respite, which is really, it's great. That's a good thing that they know that they can go outside of, you know, they can seek community resources from anyone, Jacob's Law. So, we're doing a lot of parent support for foster parents, which is something kind of new for Family Involvement Center, a lot more than ever before. So that's on the positive, and foster parents are really trying to meet. I mean, I've really seen foster parents working really hard to try to get additional resources, occupational therapy, going, looking for new resources for better OT providers and things. So that's, I mean, I think they feel very empowered to really get their kids' needs met now. And
we're running every agency since the new contract came out in October. All the agencies are required to do a support group of some sort. And what we've done here in Pasadena County is we've come together and done a support group for foster parents and adoptive parents and unlicensed foster parents as well. And we had our first one last month, and it was. So we're going to continue to do that, and we'll put it out to the foster care communities and stuff like that. So any way that we can help out those foster parents and adoptive parents, because I think when somebody adopts, things change. They have to do a new intake for their health home. They have to do all this stuff, and they get lost, and they don't know how much help they can get after they adopt. And they feel like, oh, I should be able to handle it by now. But there's so much trauma with these kiddos that they come up when, if they're, even if they're adopted at 6, they're going to have trauma at like 12 or 13 when they're getting puberty and stuff like that. So it's like how we continue with services with the kids and how we continue to help transition them over to the adult networks that they needed. If they are going to be SMI, what does that look like for them? And educate the foster parents on how to navigate those roles when they're getting 16 and 17 and 18 years old. Foster parents now, I work with the children's program, but foster parents, if the child signs on for DCS until they're 21, they're eligible to stay in that foster home. The foster home can be licensed for 18 to 21 and keep that kid in their home. A lot of people don't know that. And that's when you have a lot of the stuff out there that is kind of the crossover between adult and children's foster care. So it really is, and we found, we had a meeting a couple weeks ago, and so we found that there's a lot more people that are willing to keep the kids when they're 18, and the kids are willing to stay in the DCS system to get that help and to get TANF and to get all the other services they need, which is great. And it goes into the adult behavioral health system, too, because that's when you're going to get some of the diagnoses that are going to be the SMIs or the DMHs or whatever they are, that to be able to help them longer and be successful. So we're seeing a big thing.
Thanks. I would like to call on Tina now to give us a presentation on first aid mental health.
Thank you very much. Okay. So for those on the call or someone who has the calendar, I went ahead and forwarded an email to everyone that has a PDF of the presentation that I'm going to be discussing. So at least you'll be able to follow along of what I'm really doing. So I haven't really done it in this format, but I hope you'll bear with me. First, let me introduce myself. My name is Tina Sardinsky. I've been with Arizona Complete Health / Sympatico Integrated Care / Sympatico of Arizona / Sympatico Behavioral Health since August of 2012. I worked as an administrative assistant and worked under the Medical Services Division with the Chief Medical Officer, Quality Management, Utilization Management, Pharmacy, and learned quite a bit about just mental health in general. My first visual was IADs and seclusion and restraint reports. That's what I did. I processed those in the database and uploaded to the state. And then after a while, I got involved in helping and assisting with the quality of care investigations, kind of generating those inquiry emails to send out from that perspective for the investigators and the quality managers to review and decide if it was, you know, the determination on that. About just a little over 2 years ago, I was approached by Tony Smith, who is also at Arizona Complete Health. We got hired around the same time. And we had been offering mental health first aid to our employees, but as an admin, you don't have time to leave the building. So I kept saying, I want to go, but they couldn't afford to lose me for a day. And so Tony approached me and said, I think I have something for you. Are you interested? And he proposed that as with the new contract and the new REBA arrangement and getting Pima County and expanding, he said, we'd like to do mental health first aid full-time and we'd like you to spearhead it. And obviously nothing was in foundation already. We were doing a little. But I went ahead and as of January 1st, 2018, I started full-time, got my first certification in April, and have been building about 2 years now, and really seeing a growth. I have participated in community events as well as promoting the mental health first aid and all of our curriculum, which I'll explain what we cover in that. But what I can tell you is I'm not a licensed clinician. I don't have any credentials except my experience, my life lived experience. I have a diagnosis with depression, anxiety, with PTSD, trauma, that I found out that I was adopted at the age of 33. That posed a humongous trauma in my life, and it really put me in a spiral. So I have been in recovery and in resiliency about 24 or 5 years, and maintaining my wellness, keeping my head up, struggle at time to time, you know, because we're all human. But I think it really has brought an amazing awareness to my own wellness, as well as when you share of your story and you share this curriculum, you get an opportunity to connect, to let people know they're not by themselves, and to realize that even if you don't personally struggle, we probably have loved ones or colleagues or friends or acquaintances that might struggle, and hopefully give you a little bit of tools that maybe there might be a concern, even if it's just for a depression, just being that springboard to maybe offering some encouragement and maybe getting the proper help that they need. So I've been doing this now 2 years, and I love every minute of it, and I'm ready for my next year. Thank you for having me today. Mental health first aid is an important aspect. For my next slide, I did what's wrong. I wrote mental health can affect a person's quality of life and overall health outcomes. In 2015 and 16, more than 20% of Arizonians ages 18 to 25 reported having a mental illness in the past year, slightly below the national average of 22%. What we do know is that only about half of those individuals will receive mental health services during that time of reporting, even if they experience it, and even realizing that there was a diagnosis from a physician, actually moving forward with treatment is a very difficult thing. We have stigma attached to mental illness. Now, we can all know that our society is changing, it's becoming a lot more aware, but all of us have thoughts and ideas about what these individuals might be feeling. We get a little afraid, we are uncertain, we're really not informed enough to really make logical decisions instead of having empathy and realizing that that person might need some help. We're often deterred and maybe walking around them or avoiding them and just not confronting them. And so, for an example, I like to use when somebody comes home from a hospital or of an illness, and what do? We're bringing over cookies, we're doing meals, we're offering with housekeeping, taking care of the kids. But what happens when somebody is coming home from, you know, a recovery program who's struggling and needing to normalize their life in recovery and resiliency? Are we so quick to bring those casseroles over? Are we so quick to offer our assistance to take care of the kids? Are we so apt to offer housekeeping or gardening? And I think that if we understand mental illness better with the tools and the resources that we have, I think we're probably more apt in society to change that stigma and help others to realize this is an illness, just like cancer, breast cancer, chronic pain and illness, muscular dystrophy, MS, multiple sclerosis, all of these physical conditions are very debilitating. But if you understand and realize that mental illness can be just as debilitating, and if you've known somebody who's experienced that type of change in life and the thoughts and perceptions and the ways they are emotionally, I think we have a better relaxed understanding and comprehension and more acceptance of these individuals. They're struggling just as much as the physical condition. And that's really what mental health first aid is all about. It's really keeping it at simplistic form. We're not clinicians. We're not going to give you all these big terminologies. But what we are going to do is help you to recognize signs and symptoms of possible illnesses or concerns and give some credible resources, offer information, give encouragement, and really help that person to maybe take that step forward and moving into seeking help, professional help, getting the guidance, and of course Arizona Complete Health has advocacy that can help. The providers are aware of that. You know, we also are integrating healthcare. A lot of people will talk to their primary care, and we need to make sure that along with our partnership, that we include the mental stability, because a lot of the first type of reporting can be at the primary care setting. So we want to make sure that all those individuals are partnering with us. So if we have medical physicians that we have relationships with, letting them know that we want to help them in that area as well. So on my next one, I did do from a survey of 2,000 Arizonans reporting of any mental illness percentage receiving services by age 18 to 25, and those receiving services, so those that reported are 20.7 that are reporting that they have a diagnosis, but only 10.4% are receiving services. That's half. I mean, that's, and why is that? Number one, they don't want to be caught in the system. Number two, they don't want to be labeled. You know, we go through school in our teens, and, you know, if anybody has an IOP or they have some struggles and they had to take medication at school, they've already had enough of living with this illness, this mental illness, and not realizing that it's just something that they have to deal with. And for a lot of people, it's a brain chemical. It's a neurotransmitter that's off. It could be a traumatic brain injury from being young, or some kind of trauma that changes the chemical nature of our brain. And so we don't have exact data, but we do know that everything, our environmental influences, our home influences, our genetic predisposition influences can all be some sort of an assessment to see if someone might end up having something. It doesn't say they will, but there is a good possibility that there may be some concern later on in the future, and we try to educate and give you information for that. Going with the same survey, ages 26 and above, 17% are diagnosed with a mental illness and 12.1% are only receiving services. So again, we really want to take away the stigma. We want to take away the label. We want to use powerful, positive, influencing words to encourage that individual that they're not unique, that they can have very productive, living, grateful, loving, amazing life, even in spite of this disability. Just like any physical disability, you can have life. And I love my life, and I hope that my demeanor, my tenure, and anywhere I go, when people look at me, they say, wow, I would have never guessed. But you know what? That's the key. You know, I work hard at it. It's deliberate. And when you want something, you've got to work at it, you know. And recovery is, you have to want it. And so hopefully with that positive influence and all of our providers and all of our network are doing the same thing, we can actually get that more encouraging number up to seek those treatment services. So a couple of things that I did put out on we're talking drinking and substance abuse is another thing besides depression and anxiety being the top mental illnesses. We also have drinking and substance abuse. Mental health first aid does go over just briefly. We don't go into great detail about each substance and how it is affecting, but we do know that drinking and substance use disorders are prevalent in all of our communities. Our demographics and depending upon our regions, our rural locations, kind of the outskirts counties where the services are not as heavily available, there's a lot. We do know that there's some higher statistics with the tribal communities and some of the other communities that we have on the outside. So binge drinking is really defined as having 5 or more drinks in one occasion, and over the last 12 months for men and 4 or more for females. Although, even though Arizona is showing a national estimate being less, there has been an increase between 2013 and 17 with a slight decrease in the last year for 2019, but it is at 15.2% with drinking and substance use disorders. And so, just across the state, I didn't want to isolate only Pima County because we have representation for everywhere. Binge drinking varies. Yuma County adults reporting the highest percentage of 17.0% with binge drinking. And remember, the binge drinking doesn't mean that there's a substance use disorder and it's not vice versa. So we can't make that decision, the individual. The way a disorder or an illness is measured is by how it disrupts their work, their daily activities, and their relationships, as well as how it affects them emotionally, physically, and behaviorally. So there are a lot of keys that are involved with that. So recognizing that, and over a period of time, people can function well drinking and using. We do know of several people that do. I personally do. But we do know at some point, we all know that probably it will catch up at one point or another and affect their lives drastically. And sometimes it's almost too late. So with overdose of alcohol, death, alcohol poisoning, substance use overdose, those kinds of things. So there are some tragic results that can happen. But what mental health first aid also does is allow early intervention by us as a community, by us as friends, parents, loved ones, colleagues, and just people, our humanity on overall, that if we see something that maybe not be that is unusual, that we have the courage to step and say, are you okay? Is there any way I can help you? What can I do for you? You know, and feel good that you have credible information in your toolbox that you can help that individual. Not meaning you have to fix it, but you can direct them into getting the help they need and do a nice thing about. Similar to before even having to go to crisis. So really, what do we do? How do we help to identify, understand, and respond to the signs and symptoms of addictions and mental illness? And what we do is we come, the first aid, mental health first aid description and what it means. Mental health first aid is the initial help offered to a person developing a mental illness or substance use problem or experiencing a mental health crisis. First aid is given until appropriate treatment and support are received or until the crisis resolves itself. Now, realizing that just, you know, we've all probably taken first aid and CPR, right? So we all kind of know what to do if there's somebody bleeding. We put pressure on it and we bandage it and we tighten it to make the bleeding stop and we call for help. Mental health first aid is kind of the same thing. So if we see somebody experiencing a mental health concern or crisis, we will have the knowledge of how to handle that. And it's really in general terms. We don't give you a big script to worry about. It's just how you can intervene, get that first response to give that individual the help that they need, encourage them that they're not by themselves, and that what can you do to help them if that's calling a crisis line or calling a family member or whatever the case may be. You get to help de-escalate or assist in deflating what might be going on and get them the proper help that they need. Mental health first aid is not in any way in lieu of counseling, medical care, peer support, or other professional treatment. Where mental health first aid comes in is really just that initial help, that first response, and then we can help them through that time, whether it resolves itself or we encourage them for help. In the class itself, we look at what are we going to learn? We're going to look at risk factors and influences and warning signs of mental illness and substance abuse problems. We're going to go over information about anxiety, trauma, psychosis, and substance use, give you an idea of what signs and symptoms. And you'll see, if you have any clinical background, there's a lot of similarities in behaviors and feelings that go on with a lot of these traumas. But we kind of give you a little bit of a foundation of what to look for. We have, just like CPR, and the method for CPR is ABCs, or CAB, compression, airways, and breathing. Mental health first aid has a mnemonic similar to them called ALGI. And I forgot the bear. Mental health first aid, the mascot is the koala bear. His name is ALGI. And what I did not mention was mental health first aid was created in 2001 in Australia by a couple of professional medical and a counselor, and came into the United States around 2008 from Australia, and now this curriculum is all around the world. In 2009, Arizona adopted bringing in mental health first aid to our state. And really the big influence was the big tragedy in 2009 with the shooting of the Gifford in Pima County. And so, and as investigation was noting, Jared had mental illness. There were law enforcement had been involved. So there was a lot going on that if somebody had had training and really looked from an outward perspective and getting an idea, really looking at a whole picture from a neutral point of view, could we have prevented it? Maybe. There's no guarantee we can't go into the past. But what we can do is really take this as a learning piece and make be aware more of our surroundings, be aware of behaviors of individuals, and really recognizing what an amazing thing to be able to do if you're maybe one out of 10 that maybe says, there's something not right here. You know, we have, as human beings, we have a gut instinct, that little gnawing in our stomach sometimes, or that little brain, the little chemical thing in our brain goes off going, something doesn't feel right. And if you just have that courage to ask that one question, who can how can imagine what that outcome would be? So I think that that's a really good starting point for us as well. So ALGEE is A-L-G-E-E. And when you, hopefully I'll have all your emails and I'll make sure whoever wasn't on the invite that got added later, I'll send you the PowerPoint. ALGEE, A, assess the risk of suicide or harm. First of all, we just do a quick assessment. Are they at risk? Are they behaving inappropriately or aggressively? Are they harming themselves or going into that you don't know? You know, maybe their mind isn't clear and you're quite concerned for them. So there are questions that you can ask, and really asking that individual, are you thinking of suicide? We actually talk about that. You know, suicide is a taboo. We're afraid because we're afraid of the answer of being yes. So what do? Mental health first aid tells us what we can do when they say yes, being calm, being reassuring, giving the proper information, and assessing the risk for them, as well as if it includes someone else and or your public surroundings. It also, we talk about listening non-judgmentally, L. Listening non-judgmentally, again, we all have our thoughts, we all have our ideas and our perceptions and what we think is right. But what happens is, when I do mental health first aid, any thought that I have or any idea that might be my opinion has to go on the wayside, be left at the door, because I have to come in with a neutral stand. Not trying to fix it, not trying to diagnose, even I'm not a clinician, but being truly present for that individual. And that's, we do a lot of that. And the way I kind of use the game, remember when we were in school, we played the game telephone. The teacher starts at one end, you tell the same line, and then by the end of the line, 10, 15 people down, it's a completely distorted sentence. So what is that? Did we really listen intently with the true meaning of what is really being said? And then sometimes it's what may be not being said and being able to prompt those questions. The second piece is giving reassurance and information. As we're doing our assessment and listening, we need to let them know that there is hope for recovery. There is hope for resiliency. They can be amazing members of our community. They can participate in their own life and their own recovery. They have a choice, the voice and choice that we talk about, for our members and our community. They matter. And so we can say, I know that you can feel this. I know that tomorrow could be a better day for you. I know I'm hopeful that you are going to feel encouraged. The more you step forward, the more you make the decision to be deliberate, the more you go forward, you are going to feel better. And you're going to feel accomplished. It's going to be a self-accomplishment, not somebody else telling you what to do. So you're actually engaging them in their recovery and resiliency. And we talk about that. Of course, with reassurance and information, the first E, encourage appropriate professional help. We all know that we have the physicians, our clinicians, peer support specialists play a big part, peer-run organizations. We know 12-step recovery groups, any kind of recovery group or resiliency. Not everybody will go to the same recovery program. Each individual is different, which makes it an amazing thing that there are so many opportunities for recovery and programs where individuals go one-on-one with their peers who have experienced the same things before. I couldn't speak to someone who was an alcoholic because I have not had an alcohol and drug problem, but somebody who has experienced severe depression and anxiety and to a point of almost just becoming non-existent, I can speak on that because I've had that lived experience, and that's what this is all about, and giving them that hope and making sure that they get the right help. And, of course, encouraging self-help and other support strategies are, again, peer support specialists, our group support, self-help. You know, we have to, if as individuals, we want to make sure that we have our wellness. We're all busy. Life keeps us busy. Schedules, work, families, responsibilities. Besides the action plan for them, it's also important for the mental health first aiders to have their own self-support. I like to get my nails and my pedicure done. Okay, I like to have my hair done. I like when I'm really stressed out, I put a set of headphones in and I listen to a certain type of music. So I have strategies in place to help me during my times of struggle. And that's what we want these individuals to do, to find those resources, those help, self-help ideas. Some people like to color. Some people like to run and exercise. Some people like to journal. You know, whatever that go-to disconnect moment is, letting them know that they can be quiet in their quiet space by themselves, whatever makes them feel good, or just closing their eyes and saying, but allowing them that freedom to help them to have those self-support strategies and how to have that in place. So, and it doesn't have to be in any order, just on the PowerPoint, I went ahead and I did kind of what an overview is. It's an 8-hour curriculum right now, currently standing. There are some changes coming up, and as those come out, we'll, as Arizona Complete Health and our partners in the community, I'll make sure that all of our advocates, and I'm part of Melissa's team at the OIHA level, to make sure that everybody knows of the changes coming up. It's going to somewhat simplify the curriculum. I think we're going to find it's going to be a lot more participatory and a lot less time than 8 hours. So I'm really excited that there is one slide that I think, if everybody has it on the PDF, but I do want to show everybody here. There's a picture where it says where mental health first aid can help. And what happens is when people are well, you've got that little brownish brownie box or orange box, and you've got blue on each side and the white. Now, when someone is well, they're going along, they have their coping strategies, they're doing very well. But what happens when somebody's starting to struggle a little bit with maybe a little bit of depression? You know, part of mental health first aid will be the individual going, you know what, I've noticed things have changed a little bit. You're not your usual chipper self. Is something bothering you? Is something going on? I've noticed that you're not coming to lunch, or I've noticed that you've been eating lunch at your desk and you're usually leaving for a walk. Is there anything I can do to help? You know, and just recognizing those little idiosyncrasies, and as they're becoming unwell, and that early dialogue, that early intervention is a key, because the earlier the intervention, the better the outcome of that individual. The quicker that we can help them and move into recovery if they need it, or recognize that if it's not today, you've also opened that wonderful door that if something should, you probably will get that person approaching you going, you know, it's been a couple weeks and, you know, I really am struggling. I can't seem to shake it off. Well, let's talk about it a little bit more. Or who are you comfortable with talking? Do you want to go to, as Arizona Complete Health and our, as an employer, we have our, what is it, AOP or EOP?
EAP.
Employee Assistance Program. We have those in place. So, again, whatever resource we can use and encourage. And so, again, the earlier we notice, it also validates the individual. It also lets them know that, wow, somebody noticed. Maybe I am showing signs of something going on. I just thought I was sitting in my corner and nobody's going to pay attention to me. And so as a mental health first aider after training and that little hat, we get to be a part of that wonderful opportunity to be of value and to help another individual. And, of course, after the early intervention, we can encourage them and move them into treatment, but then that's when your handoff is. As a mental health first aider, we're complete. We've encouraged them, we've walked them through this process, and we've actually given them the resources, and they're making those steps. You can check in with them or walk that walk with them, whatever you choose to do. But it's not a requirement, but at least they're on their path. And again, the earlier the intervention, the better the outcome. So you can see where this particular area works.
Do you guys still have it separated out between adults and youth?
Yes. Yes. And, I can tell you there's a couple of other slides about that it does work. There, every year, National Council of Behavior Health does their national conference. They are making some modifications to the curriculum. I don't know a lot of details, but they're doing blended learning, like part of it will be online and part of it will be through hands-on trainer. And so that alleviates 3 to 4 hours of in-person of 8 hours. So that helps a lot. And then the materials will be reviewed. They're going to do scenarios. And that will go across the board in all of them. And that talks about what's our curriculum. We offer the adults and youth. And those are available in English and Spanish. The other curriculum is older adults. Besides our youth, the older adults are at risk of suicide. And because of, it could be accidental overdose, because of the lack of remembering medication, maybe taking too much, taking too little, not having the right system in place for them or needing the help. So we also talk about the older adult and some of the precautions and some of the warning signs and symptoms of that as well. Higher education is really about college life and what it is on a four-year university level. That is also available. We do reach out to our law enforcement and our public safety. We have a public safety module that goes law enforcement, correctional officers, justice services, so that is all part of it. And we have a group of our first responders with Maria Stengel and Amy Devins and Kelly Boyer and Candy Coughlin and Yuma. So they are focusing mostly on that particular area of the public service, the officers, the sheriff's department, the police department, all around the counties that we serve.
Are you located
there? My location is in Tempe in Phoenix. I've driven down, but we do have an office here, and I do come down frequently. I just got back from Yuma.
Are you willing to like a screening for office supervisors?
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm gonna...
Yeah.
Tina, I'm with the geriatric crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Do they do any outreach to like the 55 plus parks? It's just loaded with people needing.
Yes.
Help.
That is an area I work very much closely with the Area Agency for the Aging, and they are also doing the curriculum. That's what their focus is here
okay.
in Phoenix. But you also,
I know so many people needing this, and I don't know that I've ever heard anybody mention that they're going to attend it or that I've never seen it posted.
Right.
I just thought
it's one of those curriculums that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of feet on the ground, and that's one of the things that I wanted to spend 2020 on, is really finding out where our curriculum is going on the basic curriculum for the adult and youth because of the changes. And once that's done, I want to hit the streets and talk about those home health care providers and family members, because that's for caregivers, family members, community members. I live in an over 55 community. You never tell, but, but I do. I see a lot of that in I can imagine how many people would attend. I can't, it's phenomenal.
You've got a group, a community, and they have the community
Absolutely.
Center, which should be right for
you. Got it. That's right.
I have seen them actually. I just walk with some of the people. Thank God, I still live in an independent home, but I'm not saying that.
Right.
But they don't do that. You're right.
Yeah,
and
you've got the over 55 communities, but you've also got the residential facilities for the independent living. Which I have my 91-year-old mother who lives with me, so that's really what got me involved several years ago, just in mental health, and because I'm a caretaker, but I'm also her advocate with her medications and making sure that she's structured, and that's what I communicate to the caregivers and the people that are providing care for her. So it's really important. So, and that's where my heart is really. So. And then the other ones we do is veterans, current active military and their families. There's a curriculum specifically designed for that as well that can help family members, because that particular population does struggle there are things that have happened. And so understanding those signs and symptoms from not just the general part of the adult program, which is the main foundation of all of these programs, but the subcategories and what is applied basically to those subcategories. What's it like on college? What's it like as a law enforcement officer, fire, EMS? What is it like to be a veteran, whether it be active military, someone who has come back from active duty, and some of the signs and symptoms. And families are also included. You know, the individual with mental illness is one part of this whole big puzzle. And I've always told my kids, and I believe this to be true for me, is when somebody is affected by a mental illness or physical illness, it's not just that individual, it's the family, it's the friends, it's the relationships that are involved. And how do we, you know, how it's a ripple effect. It's about how we conduct ourselves from the outside that can also influence how that person feels on the inside as well. So what a great opportunity for us to really show that extra piece of empathy, of acceptance and genuineness that goes along with that. And so really, I have information. There's a website that goes there. I have brochures that I can email and bring to the, have Melissa bring, or, you know, put them at your offices. My contact information is easy. We can, if you want to host a course, we can work that out again. I'm hoping by May, June timeframe, I should have a better understanding of where this curriculum is going and be able to spread the good news about mental health first aid. Thank you so much for having me. Does anybody have any questions?
I love that, in that you, I know now what it is totally. I understand much more about the program. I'm excited about it. It's wonderful. Oh, somebody too with your group is doing some trauma-informed care. Is that a part of it?
My John,
one of my favorite topics is that one, and I was hoping, is that part of what you do too?
The trauma-informed care will be separate. I do know that another division, Shannon Mays, and is doing the traumatic brain injury research and information as well. And I believe we're, I'm hoping that National Council has incorporated TBI into the newest curriculum. I know that there was a blurb in the public safety module that had to do with traumatic brain injury, because officers do encounter that as part of their the nature of their position. But they didn't put that in the regular manual. But that particular module came several years later. So I'm hoping that that piece will also be addressed, even from a general information of characteristics and things to look for.
We can have John come out too.
Absolutely.
He loves
such a good topic. As I, over the years, was doing the seclusion restraint, mm-hmm. I kept running into, oh my gosh, these people are handling this client. I can tell just from the reading, oh my gosh, this isn't going to work. You know, it was just heartbreaking because to me, I believe in familial PTSD. Mm-hmm. And with, from a really rough upbringing, mm-hmm. you end up really with some PTSD issues throughout yeah. your life, mm-hmm. and you need people treating you, and clinicians and so forth, and just everyone in general to understand, I wonder what's wrong with you, what happened to you, because you're acting out in such a way. And generally, I mean, they look like, to me, some of these people that I was reading on the page, like they were cornered, and one gal kept kept pulling out her mattress out of a woman, desperately wanting to hold on to it, be near the nurses. It broke my heart. Or you know,
I remember doing those too. Yeah,
you know,
I mean, your heartbreak.
But whoever, and I just thought, wow, somebody here, and they would say, get back in, you know, to this individual, not recognizing that they were, what they were dealing with. And again, that was my excitement over all my years of being in this. That's been one of the ones that touches me probably the most is recognizing. And what I'm seeing in the elderly, as I deal more and more with them, is just that issue. If they're, all their, everything that's ever happened to them, it's coming out now, and mm-hmm. and they're getting crabbier, understandably, and angrier, and acting out, and a lot
and
of
and sometimes it, very disappointed and regretful. And guilty.
From a lot of that, too, mm-hmm. flashbacks.
Well, my mom tells me she was a horrible mother. I'm like, no, you weren't. You know, she's like, I didn't do certain things. Well, yeah, but neither did I.
She's so lucky to have you there to
Thank
say
you.
That. Oh,
well,
my
mom, my situation is also family and upbringing related. My mother is 91. She was 10 years old when her family was taken away. She's from Germany. She was she is a concentration camp survivor. My father, who passed away a year and a half ago, was 95. His family prepared the children to leave Germany, and he went to England, and he became a second seat gunner air fighter for the Royal Air Force for England in World War II. And so he also had trauma. So understanding all that history and understanding, my mother says, you know, comes out with, we just recently, I think it was less than a year ago, she decided, oh, I'm turning 91. Well, Mom, you know you're turning 90. No, I got out on the kinder car, and I had to be younger because I wouldn't get out on the kinder car. Oh. So there was no paperwork, so we changed my birthday to a year before. The year after, so I could get on. And I'm like, okay, so now I don't have to give you a party. You know, the 90th, you know. We kind of joked. But this was, she just remembered. Out of, after all these years, she just remembered. So, I mean, I'm getting, from the mental health field and the mental health perspective and my life experience, I got it all. You know, yeah. I got all the good story.
Well, between your program and...
Yes.
I'm hoping
trauma is very caring. Well, I can honestly say
that you can hope all you want, honey.
Here's the thing.
Not as optimistic. I did this class a few years ago,
okay.
Probably 7 years ago.
Oh, they say take it every 3.
So it's been a long time.
Yeah.
5 or 6 years ago, and it was a 2 or 3 day class.
Yeah, so.
There was a lot of information that a lot of things you covered. One of the things that I did hear about, maybe you said it and I just didn't hear it, which I feel like is real important and I don't hear enough about, is I'm SMI, and at one point I was a single parent. And so, and just like how you mentioned, you know, our mental state can have a ripple effect. And where I would like to see or like to hear people, this committee, or somebody address real soon, is how do we make sure if the parent is suffering especially from a serious mental illness, how do we make sure that the kids are being okay? Because my kids were just denied services. My daughter attempted suicide at 17, just a year or two ago. My son wound up in prison. But we were just denied. And I, as a parent, and a single parent, knew that I was lost. I had no clue of what to do. But there was no place, especially for me as SMI, a single parent, there was no place that I could go to that I received the help for my children. And I now see how my mental illness has had a huge impact on my children. So I would like for the committee to start really focusing on what are we doing with these kids that maybe teenagers or preteens that are dealing with a parent or parents with mental illness.
By the way, Patrick Cook is here. For those on the phone, that's Patrick. Patrick, as far as your children, for your specifics, as far as National Council and Mental Health First Aid, we have the adults working with youth. And so if there are teachers, we're working with schools, we're working with community. I've done Boys and Girls Club training, adults working with youth, and using that same frame of mind, identifying things that might be concerns of those individuals, including parents, that can take these classes. When it comes to the actual individual about helping them, this is a general overview of recognizing signs and symptoms. What you're, I believe, are speaking of is getting more in depth of research and actually doing that. Unless I don't know what our resources are, if you can assist in that area or we can direct it or get back to you.
I think the issue was is that kids were just being denied the services. You should have been offered family support is what you should have been offered. Yeah.
And we no longer have our representative Darn with NAMI. And I believe that they have committed to not NAMI. Okay. If I know, I believe they have those courses also available to help families. They have a wonderful family program, I suppose.
Family
is one.
Right.
I guess that's someone, as you describe yourself, is that right? Did you go to Family Family? I don't know.
Your kids are grown, right?
Yes, they are now.
What you're talking about is when they were younger, it would have really been helpful to have had. And I think the system has gotten better about that.
Yes.
But I know, because I work with a lot of adults who have, including my own, I have a couple of kids of my own, adult children of my own who suffer from mental illness. And we're really cognizant, and the agencies that work with them are really cognizant of the impact of the parents' mental health on the children. And so we don't work with just this or this, it's the whole family. Together, right?
It has been a lot better over the years. But I think one of the things is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but what I do think is there's a lot of times that I think adults, and even in the working with TFTs and the ARTs and stuff like that, if you don't know what service to ask for, then you don't know how to get it.
Yeah.
And I know when I was fostering, one of the things we would go into the TFTs, we would say, we need bonding and attachment therapy, we need PTSD therapists, we need all this stuff. But Tyson and I knew what to ask for. We knew how to ask for it, and because we wrote services, we ran TFT, so we knew exactly what we wanted and what we needed in our home. Where if other people aren't aware, that's something I train to with our foster parents, and even for the ones that are just coming in, we train to, if you don't know what you need, let us know, and we will help you find out what you need.
And that's the issue. Sometimes, because of a mental illness, I may not have the ability to verbalize exactly what I need. You know, maybe it's the trauma that I'm going through right now. I can't, you know, articulate that, you know. So that can be an issue, too. I just don't know who to talk to, or I go to talk to someone, and that's not the right person. I get transferred to this person and transferred. And so the frustration sometimes is just building, which is actually causing the problem to worsen. And I believe that that's what happens.
Right, and I think the other part, too, is that SMI, I think, is one category, but then when you have the substance abuse, too, and the trauma of the kid, like, when you're in those situations where you're having a bad day or whatever, you don't know what you don't know.
Correct.
So, like, the kids, you don't know how they're telling, because you're stuck in your head because of the SMI, because of the substance abuse, because of whatever else is going on, and you don't see what it is. I know that my brother with his substance abuse issues, he now, being clean for the last 2 years, he sees what trauma he inflicted on the children, but at that time, he didn't see it. So, I mean, I think it's our job as a professional to continue to educate the community and what we're doing now to what's out there and using programs like what Phyllis has and NAMI.
Yeah. I do. Always hopeful. Think that there is some. Along the way, I know we've got Senator Barto up there working, hopefully, and more and more awareness. I listen to all the news channels to hear for anything benefiting behavioral health issues all the time, and it's trickling. I'm hearing things and awareness, and even, well, I won't go into all the detail. I was just saying Me Too movement and all the latest, all these things I hope. That we're going in a better direction for each other. And that's.
And I think that we are, and that's a good point that Phil has brought up, is that the system was very different from years ago. When I went through services 12 years ago, there were 3 family support partners in the entire system.
Wow.
So there wasn't that kind of support that's there. But we do have our behavioral health advocates now. So we have a child behavioral health advocate. We have an adult behavioral health advocate. We have a veteran advocate, and then we have a CRF advocate. So I don't know if I've given you guys those brochures. I think I have them with me. I'll give you those. So we are trying to improve on that, to advocate for members, because that's no fault of your own for not knowing what service to ask for. That person that was helping you should have told you that. And things have changed directly. And there's agencies like Sharon's talking about nowadays too, that can help walk you through it.
Right.
So I think this is part of the problem was you had sympatical running and then you have different things. You know, and just over the years, whoever's up there in charge has changed. You know,
we have the committee.
Excuse me. This is. Hello?
Hello?
Yes. Hello. This is Joe with Banner. I just want to make sure that you all are aware that all of the ACC plans have member advocates or member liaisons. Okay? Mm-hmm. So
thank
I just
you,
wanted to throw that out there. Thank you.
It sounds like a tremendous improvement from I'm not in one of the agencies, so it that's wonderful news.
And that's really what's evolved in the last couple of years with what they're calling an integration of care with physical and mental health, bringing it all together with ACC and making sure that it's a whole person's plan, not just one-sided and the other side, that they're communicating on both sides. Because I truly believe the body is connected to the mind or the mind is connected to the body. If our mental health isn't good, then we usually have some physical consequences and feelings on our body. We hurt, we have headaches, we have all this stuff.
Yeah.
And then if our body hurts, if we're not really aware of it, it can mess with our minds and our thought process. And it can really debilitate some people and be a detriment and they can't function. So again, with mental health first aid, like you were saying, Barbara, that with mental health first aid, it kind of goes into the dialogue, whether it be clinicians, I try to do it from people have to do a job. And I look at it that way, and it's to no fault of their own. They have such an important position in these fields of seclusion and restraint and the IADs and the people working in these homes and level ones. And realizing that sometimes we forget about that human piece, that empathy piece. And I hope that with mental health first aid, even when we bring in a bunch of nurses and doctors, that we can kind of bring in that empathy piece and really have a feeling of emotion and attach it to the individual versus just seeing them as a case
right.
or an issue. And so that's really what this is all about.
There are a lot of us that now are doing integrated health.
Exactly. Yeah.
But as much as empathy wouldn't have made a better difference,
that's
I needed,
right.
you know, write the correct professionals, you know, in place, you know.
Right.
Yeah,
that's kind of tricky. The training for the professionals in the field has gotten a lot better. So I think not only the ACA took over, but before that, like, I've been working in the field since 2005. So I've watched it progress over the years. The training I took in 2005 versus the training I take now, it's so much more intricate and more detailed, and the information that's being given to people now is like light years ahead of where it was back 15 years ago.
I love this. I wish Officer Winsky were here. I love how they have that new training with the small papers. You know, the CID, and awareness. Basically, awareness raising is all about awareness raising on all sectors because your son, what he's been anyway, it's just
mental illness all connected and ended up a prison.
Well, that's the current hospital. It's unfortunate. Are the prisons.
And I would say, too, that don't beat yourself up because I have an SMI, because I don't. I have GMA, general mental health issues. But I did not know my son was addicted to drugs and alcohol. I started drinking at the age of 12. I had no clue until he was 19 how bad it was.
Yeah.
No clue at all, because I don't drink or do drugs, so I had no clue. So as parents, we struggle to figure out, you know, and he's 40 now, he still struggles. And so we struggle with trying to figure out what's going on with our kids.
Absolutely. You know, I had the opposite. I have, I thought my child, it was alcohol, drugs, it's something had gotten there, and it was chemical. It was a shit of problem that we had to address.
Mm-hmm.
Really rough time. Very successful now, but oh my goodness. And I didn't have a clue. It's just, it's not interesting, just the opposite, but it is what happens.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Everybody, thank you. Oh, Tina,
thank you,
Tina. That really
stimulating. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Conversation. Very good. I'm going to do, how are we on time?
That's time.
Okay. I'm sorry, Melissa, do you have any updates?
I don't. I was just going to ask if it's okay for Tina to take some of these and pass them out at the trainings that she
does. Please,
yes.
Because I've got a whole box.
You do?
There.
Okay, good.
Help yourself. Well, and the thing is I want to bring, I have a lot of partners in training from Pima County Health, and I work a lot with the other certified trainers in our areas, including Yuma, south, going south to Nogales and Stafford and Graham County. So I try to keep a list of all those. So, yeah, so any area stuff that I can use.
Thank
for,
you so much.
For
yeah, I'm real quick. I didn't hear it talk about this, but like I'm still working with people in the mental health on field, and right now at one of the shelters, people are still dying. People are still dying. We had a couple of them die within the facility in the past couple of weeks. And I know we've been talking about this over a year now about the death and incident. I don't know what we need to do, but we got to do something.
Come and join us in that, please. I just got this in my mail today. This is from Access. Independent Oversight Committee request form. And it's got an area that we could fill out that information. It's process for requests and concerns. I just got this. You can get my copy, and I'll go print some more. Because I know it's for our committee, but that's a start. And please contact, let's stay in contact so that we can get the ball rolling on that. Because thanks to you, we're going to find out about it, and then we'll get it on the paperwork and get it to them. Because they just don't know.
Don't be too.
They just
don't know. You give it down.
If the chain of communication has been, for whatever reason, buried and broken, I don't know. And we're just working every day and every way, hopefully, to
wonderful people here. And on the phone, too, but those wonderful people to try to get some connection and continuity. So. Thank you, everybody, and thank you for coming.
Oh, next meeting is all March 23rd.
Yeah, it's a Monday.
Oh, God, did I? I had covered the whole month, forgive me. That's a, I will repair that. Tuesday, the 24th is our next meeting, and I'll make sure I look. Larry, I don't know if Larry's still there. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Barbara.
I got a few agenda.